welcome to the Paranormal Peep Show once more. That's the familiar tones there. You've heard of our music, and now it brings us into our show for another Winter's Night Tales of Fun and Frolics and the Paranormal. And to join me on tonight's show is our regular co-host, it's Andy Chaplin. Andy, how are you?
Hello, Neil. Yes, very busy at the moment. As you know, I'm running Tuned In Events, which is the website and psychic events kind of thing. So I'm kind of like putting banners around, running around the place. And yeah, it's quite a manic period, actually. It's my favourite period of year, actually. Halloween is basically our Christmas in the paranormal community. And yeah, I don't know if you're a Christmas person. I'm not really. It's a bit too twee, but I do like the pumpkins and the skeletons and the vampires.
I must admit, actually, there is a smile that comes to my face when I go around some of the shops and I see some of these gadgets for Halloween, you know, the skeletons that light up and talk and stuff like that. They do amuse me, I must admit. And I have to press the buttons and play on them for a little bit. But when Christmas rolls around, I'm just not interested at all. So yeah, I do agree. I do think it is a fun thing, but also, you know, when you think about the whole thing behind it, it has a slight paranormal thing going on behind it that most people, it probably goes over their heads. I mean, they know it's something to do with ghosts and ghouls, but they don't really know the origins of it.
Well, this is it. I mean, it's originally, of course, it's Samhain or Samhain, however you want to pronounce it. And when Christianity came along, they kind of hijacked some of the pagan festivals and called it All Hallows or All Saints Eve. But it's supposed to be the thinnest veil, the thinnest time of the year when the veil is thinnest between the living world and the spirit world. And it's when most people, well, there's a lot of kind of spooky stories around Halloween, aren't they? It's kind of cold, dark winter's nights type scenario.
Well, yeah, that's right. It's always a good time to crouch around the pub fire with a log burning and things like that. And there's always one person that might have a few ghostly stories in a group. I mean, that tends to be me. I suppose that's you in your group of friends as well. And they say, come on, tell us a spooky story. Now, when you do your readings for people and you have your group of readers and everyone comes into a pub or wherever it may be, most people presumably want to know their future. But I mean, I remember having lots of readings years ago as a sort of 20-year-old or whatever. But people that did readings on me always used to bring up sometimes about who I was in a past life and was I aware of it and things like that, which I was always intrigued by, but I could never prove. I mean, did you get that kind of thing happening in your readings at all?
Well, I get to hear all sorts from both, not just the people coming for readings, but also the venues themselves. So I'm constantly going around pubs. I'm listening to all the stories that the landlords and the landladies tell me. Quite spectacular, quite unbelievable sometimes, actual kind of poltergeist phenomena happening in front of them. I'm going to do a shameless plug here. So if anyone is in the Hertfordshire or East Anglia or London area, go to Tuned In Events, Tuned with a D, In Events, on Facebook, and you'll see all of our events going on. In answer to your question, people come for many different reasons, actually. So some people want to know about people who have passed over to spirit. Some people want mediumship. Other people want to know the here and now. So that's kind of like more psychic intuition or clairvoyance. Some people want to know the future. So again, tarot cards come into play there, sometimes with spirit as well. They can kind of interchange. So sometimes a mediumistic reading can be a bit psychic. Sometimes a psychic reading could be a bit mediumistic, and sometimes a tarot reading goes into spirit as well. But yeah, there's a lot of different questions that people have. And sometimes, interestingly, some of the readers will pick up on things from past lives. Now, as a reader myself, I've actually picked up, it's really bizarre how it happens to me. Sometimes I could be talking to somebody, and if it's the right time at the right moment, I can get a feeling of like a period in time, whether it's a Victorian era or the French Revolution or something like that. And sometimes I've kind of like picked up on people's fears that relate to how they passed. So sometimes I've picked up where people have been I felt that they've died at sea, that they've drowned at sea, and asked them, you know, do you have a fear of water? Is there a fear of kind of like drowning? And they say, oh my God, yes. There's one woman actually, I think this was a pub in Enfield, and I kind of got a feeling of the cowboy era, kind of like, you know, the late 1800s. And I got the feeling of being quite afraid of gunfire and the feeling of like a pain in a chest. And I kind of felt that she might have been shot kind of in a previous life. And funnily enough, she said she'd been to America that year, which she didn't tell me previously. And she said she thought she'd really loved the gun range. She was looking forward to going on the gun range. But when it actually came to it, she was absolutely terrified and petrified by it. So yeah, that's quite an interesting one. I do believe in reincarnation, and I do believe that influences from previous lives leach into our lives now and sometimes cause either mental conditions or physical conditions that we might not be otherwise aware of. So
Now I always thought reincarnation was a tin of funny tasting milk, but then I grew up. But to maybe explain more about reincarnation and maybe even suggest that there's proof of reincarnation is one of our colleagues on the Paranormal UK Radio Network, who he works in the management department, so he helps behind the scenes. He has guested on other shows, though, on the network, and that is Stephen Sakaleros, joining us from Portland in Maine in the United States. Are you there, Stephen?
I am.
Hello. Welcome to the Paranormal Peep Show.
Thank you. Hey. Thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Well, how are you today?
Great.
Good. And what's the weather like over in Portland, Maine?
Well, it's definitely fall now, so the leaves are starting to turn. It's been kind of damp and coolish today.
Mm-hmm. Now, where is Maine in the United States? Because I think I mentioned to you over Facebook that I have been to Portland, which is Oregon, and I kind of think, oh my God, there's all these Portlands everywhere. So where is Portland in Maine, if I was trying to picture a map of the United States in my head?
Well, that's the big Portland, and that's on the West Coast. We're on the opposite coast, about as also in the north portion of the country, but on the East Coast.
Right. Okay. And as I think I said to you, my girlfriend's house overlooks the original Portland, I presume, if it's original, which is off the Dorset coast, the Isle of Portland, where ironically there's prisons there now, but we won't go into that.
Right.
There's a few celebs there, Andy, that I can tell you off air who they are. But that's another story. Anyway, so reincarnation, you have a strong interest in reincarnation. And I suppose Andy and myself, being into the paranormal, we probably had fleeting interests in it. And Andy talks about it in some of his readings with other people. I mean, how did you get into the whole reincarnation thing?
Well, I knew about it since I was maybe 19 or so and had been studying Eastern mysticism and comparative mysticism. So I just took to it immediately. It just made perfect sense. And I never questioned it. You know, it came with the whole package, basically. But then in 1997, I had a little video production company, and I had gotten into it from an interest in photography. And I didn't want to lose my creative interest, you know, my creative edge. I didn't want to go so totally into the commercial realm like a lot of people that just all their creativity just dries up and they're all about making money. I didn't want to do that. So I decided I'd have a parallel personal project. And I didn't know, I knew I wanted to do a documentary. I didn't know about what. And then I literally woke up one morning and knew it was going to be about reincarnation. So I may have had a discussion with someone that I don't remember. I may have been given my instructions. You know, I have no idea. All I know is that I woke up and yeah, it's definitely going to be about reincarnation.
Wow.
Do you think that maybe that was on a kind of like an esoteric level, maybe your higher self or something to do with the universe telling you that people on this planet really kind of need to know about past lives and this is your mission, so to speak?
It seems feasible, but I really don't know anything about it. I mean, it was literally that simple, you know. Yeah. But so then I started educating myself, you know, what's out there in the Western world about reincarnation. And I got quite an education on it. I had no idea that there was scientific research and individuals, you know, working to prove their past lives there. I had no idea there was such a thing as past life therapy, which Andy, I think you or Neil just touched on. So it was a whole new world for me.
Did you find you were up against kind of barriers and obstacles to do with the most of the mainstream thinking? Because I could be wrong, but my impression of most kind of mainstream thinkers in the scientific community that it's all a load of old hogwash.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And in the private citizenry as well, you know, in a documentary, you have to get permissions. You have to get people to cooperate, you know, and talk to you and sign release forms. And it was really a difficult maze to get through to produce a documentary, finding that it was so difficult to get permission, get anybody to cooperate.
How do you go about tracking down people that have perhaps claimed to have had previous lives for a documentary?
It's not difficult to find them. It's difficult to get them to step forward and cooperate. Like, for example, I wanted to include in my documentary the phenomenon of young children who spontaneously started talking to their parents about a past life. Dr. Ian Stevenson, the psychiatrist, had studied that. And I wanted to do that. So I was trying to get a case, and I couldn't get the other researchers, who I won't name here, to cooperate, to give me one of their cases. So I kind of put out the call through my girlfriend at the time, and she was involved in childcare industry. And it took about maybe one week or two weeks to network myself to a real case. It's not hard to find. They're everywhere. As a matter of fact, I'm in a job now where I deal with the public and sell tickets for a tourist attraction. And I've seen instances of children remembering their past lives, as I interpret it, maybe two or three times. There's one child who has an inordinate interest in trains, you know, that obviously worked with trains in a past life. And then there's two children that had phobias of the trains. One little girl just recently, when the horn sounded on the train, she was terrified. And I knew for sure it was a past life. And of course, the adults tried to reassure her and talk to her about what the toots meant and so on. And none of that got through. She remembered something that terrified her. And there was nothing I could do. I can't talk about reincarnation to the public. But it's everywhere when you start looking for it.
In actual fact, I think I'm right in saying that Christianity used to believe in reincarnation up until about the 4th or 5th century. And then there was, I can't remember, was it the Council of Nicaea, where there was one particular pope decided that we're going to get rid of half the Bible, and we're going to keep this section, and we're going to get rid of that section. And it all changed.
Yeah, that's correct. And I forget the name of it, but in 553 AD, there was a council in which the teachings of, I don't know if he's pronounced Origen or Origen, O-R-I-G-I-N. He taught about the preexistence of the soul, including reincarnation, and his teaching was made anathema. And from that point on, it was dangerous to, you know, admit that you, in other words, the real Christians got persecuted by the fake ones. it became the state religion. And at that point, you know, that wasn't, you know, Christianity anymore. It was something else.
Yeah, because I actually think I recollect now in part of the Bible, not that I'm an avid Bible reader, but I do recollect there's a part in the Bible where I think Jesus says to a young boy, "Behold, a master soul," or something like that, as if he recognized that he was an old spirit from other lives. So there's almost elements of reincarnation still lurking in there.
They didn't get all of it. Yeah. They didn't get it all out. Yeah,
that's right. They haven't weeded it all out. So there's certain elements of truth in there. But I suppose really, you know, the Bible's not a perfect book, despite what's claimed about it. So, there's certain things going on there that maybe only the fully initiated might be able to perceive more than the layman on the street. So India has always been known for being past lives with Hindu and all the various religions that they have in the Far East. Now, it's always been claimed when children seem to remember their past lives in India, that the skeptics will say, oh, that's because there's money to be made. There'll always be a poor family trying to claim that they belong to a family in a rich town, and they, sort of make up stuff, or they claim stuff, if you like, that they were associated with that family in a past life so that they can reap the benefits of that family. Do you think, is there any truth to that maybe? Or is it do you think there's genuine cases lurking in there somewhere as well?
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I mean, it may be true in a few cases, but overall it isn't. As a matter of fact, the kids generally are, either discouraged or punished by their parents. I mean, there's cases where I believe that one of the punishments to get them to stop talking about their past lives or to forget them is to spin them around like on a potter's wheel, you know, counterclockwise or something like that. So, because I mean, it's very unpleasant for the parents because the child is saying, "You're not my real parents. I want to go to my real parents," you know? So they feel rejected. And it's unpleasant for the children because they're unhappy. They, you know, miss their home and so on. And there's very little benefit in it. But the children are absolutely insistent. You know, they just won't let it go, you know.
It must be quite upsetting for the potter as well, because he can't get to do his pots with these kids being spun around on all day.
Yeah. Probably inconvenient for everybody. Yeah.
So getting to your previous life, how did you come into contact with your previous selves then, Stephen?
Well, I had been studying the best cases I could find for my documentary. It took me about 5 years to produce this thing. From 1997 to 2003, I finally released it. And I had studied the best cases. First off, Dr. Ian Stevenson's work, who studied children, including Indian children. But then there's other people. Dr. Peter Ramser in Australia used hypnosis. And he would hypnotize people who would give him specific details about a life. Say there's an example in France. This woman remembered her home and remembered a church. And if I remember correctly, the church had a tree growing out of the top of it or something. And he took her to the location and he filmed her while she saw her past life house and the church with the tree on the top, you know, and she's like hysterical. It's so overpowering, the emotion for her, you know, that she's like sobbing. You know, it's pretty dramatic. But so he did that kind of work. And then there's people like myself who remembered a past life and tried to prove it, or in one case, one famous case, tried to disprove it. And there's other cases that came up in the course of past life therapy where they're, you know, past life therapy, they're going back to the source of whatever the trauma was. And the details the person comes up with are so specific that the therapist can go and look for them in the historical record. So, you know, I don't know how many cases total, but 10 or 15 or something, you know, that I found that I thought were really strong. And I paid really close attention to the methods that each of these different groups were using. And, but in the meantime, some years previously, I'd had a psychic reading and the woman had told me she thought I was a female writer on the West Coast of the United States, probably 1920s or 1930s. She said I wrote serials and had some success with it. And so I would keep an eye out for the names of female writers that might seem familiar to me, see if I could track it down. And I stumbled upon the name Sarah Orne Jewett. Well, Sarah Orne Jewett was an 1800s writer, a 19th century writer on the East Coast in Boston. And I didn't feel like I had been her, but I felt like I was very close. So there was a fellow I interviewed for my documentary named Jeff Keane, who had his own case, and he's pretty psychic in certain ways. So I sent him the URL for this woman, Sarah Orne Jewett. They had a text project website, they called it. And he wrote back in about a half an hour and said that he'd felt guided to this particular picture of one of her friends. And the minute I looked at it, I looked into the eyes of this engraving and I said, that's me. I just felt it very deeply that was myself. The information on it said only that he was an author, that he was the younger brother of the poet, Quaker poet, John Greenleaf Whittier, gave his name, Matthew Franklin Whittier, and it gave his birth and death dates. And that's all I had to go on. And so I started from there.
And what, when you say you started from then, you started to look into it more. I mean, you kind of presumably researched that individual and what they've done in their life. But is there anything that you came across where you think, hang on, that really connects or bonds with me in some way? I mean, where do you suddenly come to the conclusion that is definitely a past life?
Well, of course, I felt it immediately as soon as I looked at the picture. But in terms of being intellectually convinced, that took maybe 2-3 years. And there were indications and counterindications. For example, I would look at the picture of his childhood home, which was a farm, and it didn't seem familiar. I tried to be very honest with myself. I didn't try to create any feelings or reactions. I tried to be honest, and I said, I'm just not feeling it, you know, and that kind of disturbed me. And there was a few other things like that. But I came to find eventually that there's a reason for that, and that is that home had been remodeled on the outside. So what I found is, in order to get that reaction, you know, a recognition or a flashback or some memories, if you're not under hypnosis, it's got to be very much the way it was. You know, it can't have been remodeled or changed or anything. And just putting yourself in the right geographic location doesn't do it for me anyway. Didn't spark anything. So it has to look just like it was before, and there has to have been some strong emotion involved. So years later, I got inside that house where it's exactly, or more or less exactly, the way it was, and I had a very strong reaction to it. But that's not what convinced me. What convinced me was having specific memories that I couldn't have known any other way that turned out to be right.
Because, of course, the skeptics often say, you just kind of like your subconscious memory is like a sponge and it will take in information of things that you've seen on TV or a movie and kind of like add parts to it. And then out it comes as a story. But presumably the finer details are what kind of puts the cherry on the cake, so to speak.
Yeah, they call that cryptomnesia. Mm. And false memory. And I knew about that from having studied these other cases. That's the first thing you want to do is to eliminate that. You also want to eliminate chance. So what you're doing is you're trying every possible normal explanation you can think of. And then what you want is a memory that defeats all those explanations. You know, so I'm my own skeptic. So I ran it through the skeptical acid bath before I became convinced of anything. So what you want is something so specific and so unique and so much hidden that you couldn't possibly have seen it before in a book or in a movie or, you know, in any other kind of presentation, and so specific that it couldn't possibly be chance. You want to eliminate those two big factors, you know, as much as possible. So I was able to, of course, it's really a matter of degree. You know, I don't know if anything is absolute proof in this world, you know, so you want the strongest evidence that you possibly can and as much of it as you can. So what you want to do, here's the method. You want to record your impressions of things that, you know, you're just exposed to. And then you want to date that. And if possible, you want to share it with someone else so you can prove that you actually did set down that impression on that date, because you don't want there to be any question of fraud later on. Say, oh, I backtracked it. You know, you don't want that explanation. So you've got to date it, and you've got to record it and preferably share it with somebody. And then you want to go find it. You know, so here's the thing. Matthew Franklin Whittier was a very obscure person, but he did an awful lot of writing and publishing, but he did it anonymously. So there's this huge body of literature that he published, but you could never find it unless you knew what you were looking for. So it was a perfect case for this kind of method. And I mean, I can give you some examples, you know, if we have a little time.
Yeah, sure. Please do.
Okay, so here's what I consider the strongest example and possibly the most interesting. I have to give a little bit of background on it. Matthew eloped with his first wife and his soulmate, Abby Poyen. She was 20, he was 24. They'd been courting for years and they had a lot of opposition from her father. Her father was a marquis. She's grown up in a upper-class French family. And her father didn't want her to marry outside of her class or below her class specifically. And so he kept putting the brakes on it. You know, finally they eloped. So when they eloped to across the border from Massachusetts to New Hampshire to a little town, she decided that she would go back 2 weeks later and make peace with her father. Well, that was a huge mistake because he apparently had her arrested where she couldn't leave town and she couldn't see her new husband. And I feel, although I can't prove it, I feel that he wanted to send her away to some kind of boarding school or something. And she was desperate, so she decided that she would have to get pregnant. It was the only way to avoid being sent away and the only way that he would agree to the marriage. Because if she was pregnant, it would be a shameful situation if she was unmarried, so he would have to let her get married. So anyway, she wanted to arrange a tryst with Matthew. So she sent a letter. She could write to his sister. She couldn't write to him. So she sent a letter to the sister, hinted that she could show it to Matthew, and she embedded code in it that she wanted this tryst. Well, I don't want to go too deep into that. But the gist of it is that they did arrange this, and she did get pregnant, and they were able to get married. But before I had figured all of that, I had some of it because I had the letter, but I couldn't figure out what was going on in this letter. It's a very strange letter because she complains she can't see her husband and she complains about fate and, you know, and she can see the sister. And it took a long time to figure out what the heck was going on. But in that process, before I had figured out what was going on, I had a vision. This was not under hypnosis. And in the vision, she is leading me up the stairs in a nice house, you know, an old Victorian house. And I'm expecting, I know why we're there, and I'm expecting her to take me upstairs to one of the upstairs bedrooms. But there's a doorway cut into the wall on the right-hand side going up the stairs. And it looks, it's cut in, it looks like a ship's hatchway, a white ship's hatch, you know, very improbable thing. And we get up to that point and suddenly she opens this thing and literally pulls me inside the room that's in there and shuts the door. And in there is like a little, like a large closet or a small, you know, linen room. And we make love in there. And that's how she gets pregnant. And that's all I remember. But it was a very intense, very vivid vision. So I thought that this was impossible. And I really had imagined this thing because there, nobody, first off, you can't physically put a doorway to a room halfway up the stairs because the bottom half would stick out the bottom and the top half would stick up into the second floor. It's not possible. And secondly, nobody would cut a hole in a nice house halfway up the stairs and put a ship's hatchway in this thing. So I figured I imagined it, but then I found it. And the explanation is that it's not really halfway up the stairs. It's actually parallel with the second floor. But visually, if you look up, it looks like it's partway up the stairs. It has three little steps that go off to the right up to this doorway. And it looks, it's white and it looks like a ship's hatchway that's been cut into the wall. And behind it was like a 9x9 room. Okay. And this, now, this is where it gets interesting. This house is directly across the street from where her family home was. And aside from the house next door, which used to be on her property, those are the only two houses in the world that I can find which have this weird architectural feature. So it's, I couldn't possibly have seen this anywhere else because it doesn't exist anywhere else. And it's very specific, you know? So, I mean, it's not 100%, but it's pretty strong because, I mean, it's just, I mean, how could I have possibly made up this thing? You know, it's too weird. So that's one of about five memories that I consider strong enough to prove that I'm dealing with a real case.
This is it. I mean, I found in psychic readings myself, both sort of giving and receiving readings, the most obscure, randomest, almost kind of that's impossible type ones sometimes tend to be the most profound and the most, as you say, I mean, it sounds so ridiculous, but when it turns out to be true,
that's what you want. Yeah,
yeah,
that's,
probability just flies out the window then at that point.
There's one, I think John Edwards told somebody that there was a dead, that they found, somebody in the family found a dead mouse in the wedding dress. And it was true. He had, you know, the wedding dress was kept in a box and they'd open it up and found a dead mouse in it. You know, I mean, it, and there's another one where Gordon Smith over there, he's being tested against a fellow doing cold reading. And in Gordon Smith's reading, he gets the name of a lullaby that her mother sang to her when she was a child. You know? And the guy doing the cold reading gets just general stuff like she's a little shy around strangers or something. You know, it's real clear which is the real medium and which isn't. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Which
was the one on this morning that went up against Chris French doing cold readings?
That was, I think, what Stephen's on about, is that was what Trish Robinson told us, who was a guest we had about a year and a half ago on the Paranormal Peep Show when we were talking about mediumship. And she knows Gordon Smith. And I've actually seen Gordon Smith a few times do demonstrations. I mean, He is from Scotland originally, but he travels around the world now. He's pretty well known, but he is an excellent medium. And I think I related the story, which I think Trish Robinson, when we interviewed her, she says, yes, I was the lady doing the pre-talk for that. And it all kind of came back in my mind. Like, oh, yeah, I have met Trish. but that particular thing, again, it's one of those obscure things, is that he was given this reading to this Indian lady at the front row of this spiritualist church. I think it's called the London Temple, if memory serves me correct. And he was given this reading to her, and he was saying, oh, your mother's here, and she is telling me about your brother. Now, your brother's a nice guy, but he is quite a manipulative fellow. He will tend to wrap you around his little finger to manipulate you to the way he wants you to, you know, do stuff. And this woman's going, all right, okay. And then Gordon Smith's face dropped, like you're thinking, oh my God, this guy looks so embarrassed now. Because then he suddenly said, oh my goodness, they've just told me your brother is here in the room. And then he pointed him out, and he was sitting at the far back of the hall, right over in the corner. so as not to be associated with the sister. Because obviously they're Indian people, and you don't really get Indian people going to spiritualist churches. I have to say that. Yeah. So obviously, if they sat together, you'd associate them together. So he must have said, "Well, I'm going to sit right at the back because I don't want." And they pointed him out. It didn't work. And they pointed him out, you know. And it was a cracking piece of evidence, really.
That's wonderful. I saw another with him online where he got the first, middle, and last name with no guessing. You know, bang, bang, bang. You know, I mean, you just can't do that if you don't have something going on.
Yeah. But that's right. Because Chris French, who was the guy that was you're talking about doing the cold readings, they were on this TV program together, I understand. It's a popular daytime chat thing called This Morning. And it was obviously our medium's real type of thing. And they had Gordon on there doing his stuff. And so they decided to do a random test, which was set up by the skeptic, Chris French, who would get, you know, just callers that would ring in. And like you say, Gordon took a call from someone and relayed all this information really accurately and specific stuff. And Chris French then did random stuff saying, "Oh, you're quite shy as a kid," or whatever like that. And the lady sort of said, "Well, out of the two, I think, you know, Gordon's got the better reading." And then afterwards, apparently during the, you know, when they went to a commercial break, Gordon and Chris French, the skeptic, both went outside the studio to have a cigarette break, and they're both standing there chatting to each other. And Chris French allegedly says to Gordon, he says, "You made me look an idiot in there." And he said, "Well, you made yourself look an idiot because you were the one that set up the test." So that's great. You know, that's a big strike against the skeptics, really.
Well, now, the one I saw, I don't know if it's the same one, but the skeptic came up with the explanation that Gordon gets to practice a lot more than he does. But see, that's irrational, because that's not what's going on. It's not, you don't get that kind of stuff from practicing the cold reading technique. It's a totally different dynamic.
Well,
yeah, I would have thought people that specialize in psychology should be the experts at it.
Yes.
Surely.
Yes, you'd think so. How to manipulate people and how to read body language specifically.
Their entire field is psychology, so surely they should be the experts at it.
The only way you can get results like that and not have genuine mediumistic ability is if you have plants in the audience.
Go ahead. Go on.
Well, I was going to say, I studied John Edward, you know, online and on TV, you know, with my list of skeptical, you know, explanations, normal explanations. I kept checking them off. Finally, I got down to two, and one of them was editing. You know, that they made it look a lot better than it was because they just showed the good ones. And the other was plants in the audience. So I went to see him live. And when I saw him live, there was he pointed out two women that were like, he actually ended up standing right next to me, right behind me on the aisle. And he pointed out two women about 15 feet away from me. And, you know, he gave specific details and so on. And the one woman hadn't been able to say goodbye to her mother. And so she was crying. Well, 15 minutes later, we're standing up and we're getting ready to leave. And I turned around and look, and this woman's still crying. Nobody's looking at her. Nobody's paying any attention to her. A plant, an actress, would not still be crying 15 minutes later when everybody's getting up and leaving.
Well, unless she didn't get the check.
She might have been crying for that. I hadn't thought of that, actually. But there's always some explanation. Yeah. But you know what I'm saying? To me, I checked off plant because that was not consistent with that.
Well, one of those "oh my God" moments about 3 years ago with a very young medium here in the UK called, his name, Ross Bartlett. His name is, he's down from the Southwest, I think Southampton area. He's probably about 26 now. So he's probably about 21, 22 when he did this reading. And my girlfriend had originally seen him. We'd heard good things about him. My girlfriend said, "Oh my God, he's absolutely brilliant. You've got to come and see him," you know. So a mutual friend of mine, a guy called Gary, I used to be in his psychic developing circle. I said, "Gary, you got to get this guy because you do all the bookings for the mediums. Get this guy to your spiritualist church. He's really good." And so maybe about 6 months later, he managed to book this Ross Bartlett. And my girlfriend and Gary said to me, I'll reserve you two tickets. So we said, "Great, okay." We arrived slightly late, my girlfriend and I, because we couldn't find which building it was, because there was five buildings and they all look the same. And we'd just seen the picture on the internet. Oh, well, that's it. But when you get there, there's five buildings, they all look the same. Oh my God. We went to every bloody building and finally, it was always the last one, isn't it? We went in and we sneaked in and there was a guy in a white shirt, a table by the door. And he was obviously the guy you paid the money to.
Right.
And he just whispered, he says, pay me afterwards. We went, okay, thank you. You know, whispering because Ross Bartlett had already started his readings. Yeah. So it was indicated to us that there was a couple of seats over in the corner sort of thing. So we sort of sneaked and sat down really feeling embarrassed that we're intruding during the start of it. And anyway, he finished his reading for this person that was, during the time that we arrived. And then he suddenly looked to me and he says, I'd like to come to the gentleman on my left, because I was sitting to his left. Mm. And I said, oh, thank you. So I quickly pressed my digital audio recorder, which I always take for these things, because you want to look back on these things.
Right.
And he started to talk about various things. And he was talking about a name like Evelyn. And I said, I'm sorry, I can't take the name Evelyn. I just don't know who you mean. He goes, Evelyn, who's married to Edward. And I said, sorry, I just don't know. And I kept thinking, are you sure you haven't got the guy behind me or something? But then he suddenly said a kicker. And he said, Evelyn is talking about Morgan. Now, Morgan is my daughter. So I kind of sat up and I thought, oh, my God. And she likes to visit Morgan because she loves children. And but then during this part, he suddenly paused and he looked worried and doubtful. And he sort of thought, I don't know if this is going to be right. But he said, OK, let's go for it. And he says, just see that guy over there in the white shirt. And he pointed to the chap that was sitting by the door that took the money. And he was wearing a white shirt, an elderly gentleman. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, that guy over there, his name is Chris Hayes. And as soon as he said that, I thought, oh, crikey. And then he said, they're telling me that Morgan, my daughter, also is connected to a Chris Hayes. And I said,
oh, that's the way they work.
Absolutely right. I said, my daughter has been going out with a guy called Chris Hayes for the past 3 years. And the whole room erupted clapping. Thought, how the bloody hell can you arrange that? You know,
yeah. Very nice.
And that's no way called body reading or prearranged.
And that's the way the spirits work. They pointed out that guy.
And then the sequel to that was, obviously, I couldn't figure out who this Evelyn was. And so at the end of the reading, maybe a day or two later, I went and saw my mum and I said, oh, you know, listen to this. And I played her the recording. And I said, but who's Evelyn? She goes, I don't know. I just don't know who she is. So then she got onto my dad's sister, maybe a day or two after that. I was speaking to my dad's sister on the phone. And she relayed this reading that I had. And she said about the name Evelyn. She goes, oh, I know who that is. And she goes, who's that? And she goes, that's your Auntie Doris. Uh-huh. Now, when I was a kid, my dad had an auntie and we called her auntie, but everyone called her Doris. And that's all I knew, Auntie Doris. And I always remembered that she had fingers missing. Yeah. And apparently Evelyn was her real name. Doris was her middle name, but she didn't like to be called Evelyn. So she just swapped them around. Everyone knew as Auntie Doris, you see.
Yep. Yep.
And then it all fell into place because when Ross Bartlett said, Evelyn, who's married to Edward, I then remembered that Auntie Doris was married to Uncle Ted. Edward.
Yeah. And they give it that way. They don't give you the obvious thing. They give you something that's going to make you work a little bit so you'll know it was real. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So this is why, you know, these skeptics have a real uphill struggle when they're trying to prove things like that. You know,
well, especially because in these sessions that you see where there's misses, they probably weren't really misses. They just, you know, you don't see that they went home and, you know, and 5 weeks later they checked on it. You know, every once in a while they'll follow up like that.
Yeah, that's right. And so when you had that kind of reading, a cracking reading like that, and you know that you're not a plant in the audience, you know you're not getting money for it or anything like that, you know that that is something quite extraordinary happening. And
when you see enough of these, you know, it's obvious that it's genuine. Because I've watched every one that I can find on YouTube, you know, quite a number of different mediums, and it's just in your face, obvious that this is a real phenomenon. You know?
And of course, Andy and I met in a psychic developing circle, so we both know it's real because otherwise Andy wouldn't be out there doing it. Andy, you want to come in on this a little bit?
Yeah, and you know, purely from a kind of financial monetary point of view, I mean, I do enjoy doing it, but you know, it does kind of pay bills as well. I'm not going to spend money on plants.
Because if I'm
doing an event, and my events aren't huge, they're not kind of like Gordon Smith, you know, James Van Praagh big. They're quite small little pub events. So they're small little function rooms. I don't know if I've got two people coming through the door or 50 people. It averages usually about 10, 15, 20. I'm not going to take, you know, the money that we get on the door and spend yeah, it on plants. Right. And also the other thing I would say is that if somebody is a plant, in an audience, they are being paid, surely they would try and make more money, because they're obviously taking money for being a plant. If that was the case, then they'd have like a certain level of deception. Surely they would then go to the newspaper saying, hey, I've got a really good story for you, I was actually a plant at one of these
events. They'd make even real money that way. Yeah.
So where are they? The skeptics would probably say, oh, well, they might have signed a non-disclosure agreement, which is possible. But on the smaller scale, what I do, there's no way we can afford a plant. And yet we still have the same type of information, the same decent level. I've got some very good mediums working for us at Tuned In Events who give some fantastic readings. And what I find with the skeptics, they're always kind of like they have a fallback position. And when that fails, they have another fallback position.
The last one's into the grave.
So then if it's not plants, oh well, it's just lucky guesses, of course. You know, it's they could have given a million names, and you know, if you struck three names, but to get kind of like a first, middle, and a last name, you know, then they've got to go to their next fallback position, whatever that is.
Yeah, I don't know what that is. It's just to deny it, I think.
Yeah.
At some point, they just deny it.
I saw this guy on YouTube, a youngster, who thought he was very clever by going out researching mediums, you know. And so he took a video camera and filmed this guy that gave him a reading. And he was quite impressed with it. So he went to his magician friend, and this was also on the video later on. He said, well, how did he get this? He goes, oh, it's quite simple. What he's done is that he's spoken about your grandfather who died of such and such an illness. Now, he's got your name ahead of the thing because you've booked it. And he's gone and called up your granddad on the records of births, deaths and marriages. He's bought a copy of your granddad's death certificate, which says the death. So that's why you can get, you know, the death of your grandfather quite accurately. And this guy goes, oh, that's so clever. You know, so that's how they do it. But what you fail to realize is that that guy, if he is buying death certificates for every single person he's doing a reading for, they're about £10 each or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he's got to go there, spend his time doing this kind of research, and then spending money on just one small piece of evidence about what granddad died of or something, you know.
If he's doing a platform show, he's going to be doing, depending on the duration of it, he's going to be doing 10, 15, maybe 20
Absolutely.
People. So he's got to remember it all in the right order for the right people. If he fluffs it once and he gives the wrong information for the wrong person once, then that's game over. So he's got to remember it all perfectly.
Well, the other thing is that all this stuff has been studied under laboratory conditions by Dr. Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona. So he's eliminated all these things. And he still gets, I don't know what it is, 75% accuracy, you know, even when the medium doesn't see the person and doesn't know who it is, you know, so all that stuff's already been dealt with.
So why wouldn't he, if a skeptic would say, well, why doesn't he take the James Randi $1 million challenge then?
Well, because James Randi won't give it to you. He finds some excuse not to give it to you. I would assume,
It'd be. I'll tell you what would happen. It would be the bar would be raised higher and higher and higher. So you'd start off, and maybe you'd get kind of like a 50-50 thing, and maybe you get it right. You know, 75% of the time you get a 50-50 thing. He would then go, okay, well, let's do a test where it's you know, 1 in 5 chance of getting it right. And if you do well in that, oh, okay, well, let's do it 1 in 10. So you'll be jumping through hoops like a good little poodle, and for him it's a nice little ride. And for you, I always say, kind of like, the reason why genuine psychics will never take the James Randi test is because genuine psychics know that it's a load of BS. That it's not. He has no interest, I believe personally. He has no interest in finding out if there's anything actually real out there. His interest is in making intuitives and psychics and mediums look like idiots. That's his agenda, which is why true ones won't touch him with a barge pole.
Well, I remember reading, there's a book by a medium, a Welsh medium called Stephen O'Brien. He used to be quite big in the 80s on TV. You don't really see him much now. I did see him once in the town of High Wycombe in Buckinghamshire, and he was very good then. But I remember reading his book, and I remember seeing him on the time, I think, in the mid-80s, James Randi had a UK television show about, you know, psychic powers and let's put them to the test kind of thing. Now, this Stephen O'Brien medium said that during the recording of this, I think that a lot of these mediums were getting absolutely bang on hits on readings that they had to do for people that are standing behind screens, if I recollect. Mm. And they were getting them right. And James Randi basically just stopped recording. He says, stop the cameras. That's it. You know, we're going to have to do something about it, because they were actually looking to be too good. And mm-hmm. that's not obviously the way he wanted it, you see. So that's just a little snippet there that, you know, that these people are supposedly going to test you. Well, if it's not going their way, they're definitely not going to proceed with it, basically. Right.
I tell you what I love. I'll believe it when I see it. I've got such an open mind. I'd love it to be real. Love it to be real. If only there was just this little bit of evidence that could just prove it to me. And as you just said, Neil, when the evidence is presented, they don't want to know and shut it down.
Yeah, yeah. My mind is made up. Don't convince me of otherwise. That's the
right
thing.
Right. Now, so, one of the things I did was I used a couple psychic mediums in my own research, and they were extremely strong too, especially after 10 years of delving into the historical record. I found that they were extremely accurate, but one of them got the first name of my past life, Matthew, but it was given in such a way that it was paired with a small town that he had lived in, and neither he nor I knew that he had lived in that town. So when I was able to later on prove that, in fact, he and his wife had lived in that town, then you can see why it was paired like that.
Yeah, yeah. So,
because there was no way that he could have known or that I could have known that.
Yeah, so it's not like reading into situations or wishful thinking
or
anything like that.
He wasn't reading my aura. He didn't get it off the internet. It wasn't anywhere. You know, I had to really dig to find it.
Now, you mentioned hypnosis in some of these cases. I mean, whether, you know, you talked about the Australian documentary you talked about earlier. I do recollect, and I probably still got it on an old VHS tape somewhere, about reincarnation, an Australian TV documentary, which again talked about a lady in France and she was taken there.
It's now, the same one, I think, yeah.
It could be. Now, it's something about a stone flag floor that had some inscription.
That's correct. That's the same case.
And
yeah, exactly.
It's only when you brushed away the straw or something that you would see this inscription on the floor that this lady who had never been outside Australia talked about.
I think she had actually sketched it.
Yeah. And there was another lady who I believe died in a previous lifetime as a victim of one of the concentration camps or something. She met her father on the other side. Now, they were all regressed by hypnotists. Have you tried that kind of experience, Stephen?
I did. I tried that also. I would have to say I was not a very good subject. You know, a good subject will go into a deep trance, and I was only able to achieve a relatively light one. But in the state that I was in, memories would suddenly just bubble up. And I was able to prove some of those historically as well. So it works. I think here's my take on hypnosis, because there's some researchers that think it's useless for past life research. And I don't think it is. I think it has to be handled very carefully. First of all, the person that's being hypnotized has to have a strong commitment to honesty and to rigorously recording whatever they experienced. So, you know, in other words, if you didn't experience it, you don't say you did, and vice versa, just whatever happens, and you're prepared to say nothing, you know, if nothing happens. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that the hypnotist has to, first off, you have to be sure the person actually goes under, because I videotaped some hypnotic regression sessions for my documentary, and I was never convinced the person was actually under hypnosis. You know, it seemed to me they were just imagining things, because the hypnotist was so quick putting them under, kind of a cursory thing. And now all of a sudden they're supposed to be under. There's no test to see if they're under. And the hypnotist is encouraging them to use their imagination. So they're imagining all these things. There might have been some real material, but it was a very, low signal to noise ratio, you know, awful mm-hmm. lot of noise. Mm-hmm. So I didn't use them. I used one scene as an introductory, you know, B-roll, and that's all I used for that reason. So you have to be sure they're hypnotized. You have to be sure that they're really have a strong dedication to telling the truth. And then maybe you can get some material that can be proven in a historical record. So I was able to prove three or four pretty strongly.
Wow. Now, I've been hypnotized for regression, and what you're saying there about these people not being put under very well, I kind of agree there, because I felt that my monkey chatter mind was interfering too much, and I felt that I should put on a performance of some sort to the hypnotist to play a role with him.
There's pressure to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you have to be able, the person has to be able to resist that pressure.
Yeah, so it puts a bit of a stress on the person who's supposed to be relaxing, in a way.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I went to back sometime in the cavalry or something like that with Native American Indians. You know, and you could say quite rightly, oh, it's because you watched Westerns as a kid and that's a kind of a good historical drama to use, you know. And I quite agree that possibly was the case. So how do they get these people? I mean, what is there a specific technique that has been found to work time and time again to get these people to regress to a state where they're definitely tuning into a past life?
Well, I'm not an expert on hypnosis, but I think a lot of it depends on the person. There's some people that are just naturally predisposed, and there's other people who can't even be hypnotized. You know, I was somewhere in the middle. It was very difficult, but I did finally, you know, go under at least a little bit, enough to where I could, like I said, some memories kind of bubbled up. But a good example would be Captain Robert Snow. He was the head of homicide investigation, a professional detective for the city of Indianapolis here in the United States. And one of his co-workers on the force urged him to, you know, taunted him, really, you know, dared him to get a past life regression, because she used hypnosis in her work. And he just kept brushing it off. And finally, to quiet her, he went ahead and went through with it, you know, just to get her to shut up, you know, and stop bothering him. So he, of course, is professionally trained to, you know, be rigorous and only look at facts, you know. So he's lying there, you know, or sitting there in the chair. And the only thing he experiences for about half an hour is that his back hurts. You know, there's nothing happening. And then all of a sudden, he's plunged into this complete 3D immersion experience of reliving three past lives in a row. And the last one could be historically proven. It was a painter in the early 1900s, James Carroll Beckwith. And so when he came out, he said he had 30, he could write down 30 points that could be proved or disproved. And he was a skeptic, so he was determined to disprove this thing, you know? So he researched it. He finally found James Carroll Beckwith's diary and scrapbook. And he went into that thing trying to disprove those 30 points, and he proved them. They were all correct, and he had to believe it. Well, if reading between the lines, I think he lost his job, and he may even have lost his marriage. I'm not sure. I kind of get that feeling. I mean, he lost everything as a result of publishing a book about it and coming out. Well, now he's an author, and he's back into, you know, forensics and, you know, terrorism and so on. And he really doesn't emphasize this past life thing anymore. But
oh, that's a shame.
Well, I think he realized there wasn't that much money in it, and it was killing him, you know, socially and financially. Yeah. So he kind of de-emphasized that, which unfortunately I have information on my website about him and his past life case. So when he comes out with a new book about terrorism and people search his name, they end up on my website reading about reincarnation, you know.
But looks like you'll be reincarnating fairly soon then.
Yeah.
And it just goes to show, actually, that case just goes to show that the mainstream thinking is against it. And when you hear people saying, oh, well, if it was true, you'd see it in the news. Well, no, you wouldn't, because of that very reason.
His case should be in the news.
Yeah, it should be.
I mean, I talk about credibility. I mean, who has more credibility than a professional detective like this who was trying to disprove his own case?
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Yeah.
But the thing is, the public at the level they're at, and it's not every single person, otherwise we wouldn't have shows like that where people are listening to our sorts of discussions. But generally, the game show people that watch game shows and that sort of stuff that don't even think about this sort of stuff, for them to suddenly sort of accept, A, you live on after death, and B, you might have past lives as well, and you know, oh, you might have a spirit guide, or you might have a higher self. It's all too much of a pill for them to swallow, really. You know, they're just contemplating on a little bit of people, oh, can we get people to Mars type of thing, you know. And so this is like, it's just beyond their realm of experience or even understanding. It's quite extraordinary.
It's too much, and also it challenges them too deeply, because for one thing, if there's really reincarnation and if karma comes in with, there's 100% accountability for everything you do. And, you know, we just got rid of eternal hell and replaced it with science. And now we've got this thing that says that we're accountable again. Nobody wants that. You know, it's a very hard sell. You know, nobody wants to be accountable. See, so there's that. Then there's the identification with the physical body. And of course, there's other areas like mediumship that's challenging that. But, you know, if I'm not the physical body, then what the heck am I? You know, it just changes everything.
And so what do you believe about this idea then that we actually coexist with all our past lives and future lives at once in a simultaneous time?
I don't believe it.
No? Okay.
No, I don't buy it. And here's the thing. I think it's a distortion of, see, this goes back to my background in Eastern mysticism. This is a distortion of a teaching in Eastern mysticism, which says that if you experience reality as it is, if you get to this high level of spiritual realization where you see everything, experiencing everything as it really is, you experience everything in the present moment. Okay, but that's for those people. That's not for us. So what's happened is that teaching has been kind of brought down and melded with our ordinary experience. And the philosophical amalgam that's come out is that all of my lives are happening at the same time, and they can influence each other and they can talk to each other and stuff. But that's not what came out of my study. That's not my experience. I can read my past life writing. I've got 2,100 of my published works now. And I can see my own mind working exactly the same way back then as it did now. And I can compare my writings and see that it's the same higher mind is working, you know, hadn't changed a bit. But I'm not talking to that person. I am that person. I say now, I'm still that. In other words, I'm still the same person. Just because I have a different body and a different physical personality, it's still the same higher mind. It's continuous. You know, so it's not that he's separate living back then. You know, I'm still the same guy. You know,
So you believe that you're writing now in your present life, and you wrote as an author or a writer of some sort in previous lives. Now, when people go on to do future lives, if you like, after past lives, is there always a connection of professions, i.e. that you were a writer in the past, so you're going to be a writer in this life, or you might have been an aviation pilot in the past and you've got an interest in flying in this one, or do they not have any connection at all like that?
Well, the talents, once developed, are always in there somewhere, you know. But whether they manifest in another lifetime depends on karma, depends on your life lessons that you're here to learn. In other words, if you didn't get it right the last time and you need to come back to whatever you were doing and get it right and fix it, if you're not finished with that, you know, you may have a lot of the same talent still. So I can write pretty much as well as Matthew could. You know, I mean, if I really put my mind to it, I can still do the things he did. I can still debate the way that he did. I can still use sarcasm if I want to, the way that he did, although I've learned to back off on it. You know, I don't use it as he was a satirist, you know, but I've learned to back off on that. I'm very careful about when I use it, but I can do it, you know. So yeah. I have there's other talents he had that I don't have. He was he freelanced as a bookkeeper. I couldn't anywhere near do that, you know. So he could do math. I can't. So there's a few things that are different, but most of it's the same. But that's because I really had a lot of unfinished business in that life. So that I'm coming back to very much the same lifetime almost in order to try to get some of those things right.
Okay, that's great. Well, what we'll do, we've reached the first half of the Paranormal Peep Show on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. So we're talking to Stephen Sakellaris about his past lives. And join us in part two for where we'll delve a little bit more into his past lives and see what else we can dig up. So that's the Paranormal Peep Show on the Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Imagine no longer being tied down to your computer, but having the freedom to take live talk radio with you anywhere you go. TalkStream Live introduces our first ever iPhone application. The talk shows you follow now follow you, and your iPhone is now the fastest and easiest way to stay connected to the best talk radio on the internet. Listen to live talk shows 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. TalkStream Live, now available in the iTunes App Store.
And welcome back, Mr. Trump. How did you find the Black Hell? Well, I found there's no evidence of Russian collusion there, just an empty void. So instead, I listen to Paranormal UK Radio Network.
Welcome back, folks. It's Andy Chaplin here with Neil Geddes Ward on the Paranormal Peep Show. We were with Stephen, and I'm going to get your name on, Sakellarios.
Perfect.
I got it. Yippee. Okay. Okay. So, Stephen, I understand that you have got, you kind of done the rigorous stuff. We went into a little bit of that and the evidence side, but we were talking during the break about some of the, what I would call the woo-woo stuff. So take it away, Stephen, about the woo-woo stuff.
Yeah, okay. So here I did this, what I consider to be rigorous research, given that I don't have funding, I'm not a scientist, but I had studied the methods and I tried to apply those methods and I tried to be really honest. Dr. Ian Stevenson had a very interesting analogy. He says it's like tennis. He says if the ball is out, you call it out. And if it's in, you call it in. Okay, so that means strictly honest, you know, reporting and investigating. So I've always been like that. And Matthew was like that. Okay. So I've just continued. This is the higher mind has these values and, you know, and they just continue from one life. So this is me, like, so I started getting these results. Well, the first thing that happened was before I ever found out about Matthew, or no, it was like a year after I found out about him, but I hadn't done any research. And I had the sudden feeling, you know, I think that as Matthew, I had something to do with the writing of A Christmas Carol, Charles Dickens' story about Scrooge. And I put that in my blog and it's public. I mean, I've got a public record saying that, and I didn't know where it came from. It was just out of the blue, just a feeling. But I said, you know, I should record this publicly in case it ever comes up. So there's that. And then under hypnosis, a few years later, when I had these two hypnotic regression sessions in 2008 and 2009, I started remembering meeting with Edgar Allan Poe, the author of The Raven. And I mean, I you know, I've got it on tape and I described what the meeting was like. I didn't remember sharing any literature with him, any unpublished pieces with him, but I remembered having this kind of, like, we were checking each other out. You know, he had a reputation for being smart. And you know, I just wanted to see, what's this guy about? And he probably wanted to say, you know, what's this guy about? And we had that kind of a meeting, you know, more like a sparring of minds than a meeting of minds, I would say. That's what I remembered under hypnosis. It had no context. There was nothing that triggered it. There was no reason for me to remember that. I didn't know anything about Edgar Allan Poe. I hadn't studied the history of his works. You know, it just came up out of the blue. So there's that thing. And toward the end of the session, I asked the medium, I said, well, can I prove this? And she says, it is possible to prove, but you'd have to dig very deeply into the record to find it, is what she said. So I had that, but I didn't want to research it myself because I felt like I would muddy the waters. You know, I felt like I would confuse matters if I went in and tried to research this myself. I wanted somebody else to do it, excuse me, and I could just kind of react to their questions. Well, you know, nobody else is interested, right? So it falls on me. So finally, years later, I started looking into it, you know, how it was written or how it was supposedly written and the circumstances and the context and, you know, what Poe said about it. But I also started finding these clues. And the clues told me that Matthew had actually written it, that he was pissed about it. But he couldn't say anything publicly, but he did say things in code in his writing. He put these embedded references in his writing that made it real clear that Poe stole this thing from him. So unless you have anything you want to say, I want to kind of give the scenario as I've determined it must have developed, and then we can go into the clues if we want to.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay, so this is what I think happened. Matthew's first wife, his soulmate, Abby Poyen, died after about 5 years of marriage in March 27, 1841. And Matthew was devastated. So he began writing tributes to her, poetic tributes and prose tributes to her. And for some reason, during this same time, I'm talking 41, 42, up to 43, he was sending his unpublished work to various literati, various famous writers, to get their feedback or just to promote his career or for whatever reason he was doing it. And Poe was one of the people he must have shared some of his unpublished work with. And I would guess he shared this stuff with a lot of people, 98% of whom were quite honest and fair and didn't use his work and just gave him some feedback, maybe people like Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who, see, all these people knew his brother, you know, these famous writers. His brother was a famous writer, John Greenleaf Whittier, who was 5 years older. So Matthew was the little brother in this circle. So he knew all these famous people. So he probably sent his work to a lot of his brother's friends and got feedback and stuff. But there was a few people that were unscrupulous enough to use it. And plagiarism was really a problem back in the 19th century. So he shared The Raven, which was written in grief and also as a faith crisis, an expression of his faith crisis, written for Abby. He shared with him Annabel Lee, which was written for Abby. And he also shared with him, I think, Some Words with a Mummy, which was a humorous kind of a dig at quack medicine. Fast forward until 1845, Matthew is now living in New York. He's writing a review column, an essay column for the New York Tribune, a big paper there. He's for many years has signed with a star, a single asterisk. He used it back in early 1830s. He's using it again in 1844, 1845. And there's a backstory to that. It symbolized, well, Abby was an astrologer and she loved the stars and she saw stars as living beings. And she probably thought of Matthew and Abby's soul as twin stars. And so after her death, he would sign with a star as a tribute to her. So he was writing these things and signing them anonymously. All his work, almost all his work is anonymous under hundreds of pseudonyms. He stayed very much undercover. So he was writing this this column and this reviews, but this thing has been attributed to transcendentalist Margaret Fuller. Well, she didn't write them. She was the literary editor of the paper, but she falsely took credit for this series. So that's one piece of intrigue that's involved with this. Then in February of 1845, Matthew submits The Raven to a publication, a new publication. This is its second edition, called the American Whig Review. And he signs it blank Quarles. It's a reference to an English poet of a couple centuries earlier named Francis Quarles. Francis Quarles was a deeply religious poet whom Matthew admired, and I know he admired him because he wrote about him back in 1831, 1832, and shared some of his pieces and so on. So let's see, follow the story. I think it was a couple weeks before this poem was published in American Whig Review, signing as the asterisk in the New York Tribune, Matthew praises Francis Quarles' poetry once again. It was in a compilation by Longfellow that he reviewed. And then right before it came out in the February edition of the review, Edgar Allan Poe comes out with the same poem with a couple little changes, The Raven, in the newspaper that he wrote for. He was also a critic, and he wrote for a competing newspaper, the New York Evening Mirror. So, but being a critic, Poe would have gotten an advance copy of the review. So he gets the copy before it's printed, and he sees that the poem that he was planning on stealing is, you know, getting published. So he quick convinces his editor to get it out to scoop him, and puts his own name on it. Well, Matthew in New York City is doing very ticklish anti-slavery work, undercover work. He's involved with the Underground Railroad. There's a lot of people connected to him. He has to stay secret. That's why he signs with an asterisk and doesn't use his name. So he can't publicly, you know, defend himself. So what he did was to publish these innuendos, you know, that are real clear. Once I learned Matthew's code, his method of expressing himself, you know, undercover through innuendo and reference and inference and so on. It's real clear that he's saying, you know, I wrote this and Poe stole it from me. And there's a whole bunch of examples. We don't even have time to go into all of them. I can go into one or two examples, but you don't get the full weight of it unless you really see all of them together. So that's the gist of it.
So Matthews, because I was going to ask that question about why couldn't he just come forward? And you said that he was working undercover. Was he an agent of some sort then?
Apparently he was. At some point in late 1840s, early 1850s, it looks as though he was reporting to William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist. And William Lloyd Garrison was not only an abolitionist, he was a disunionist because his motto was no union with slavery. So he wanted to break up the union, get the South out of there. You know? So it was doubly radical. You know, but apparently what would happen is that Garrison would send Matthew as a liaison to meet with somebody representing him. And then Matthew would report back, but he would report back in a travelogue public column in such a way that you could see what his contacts were. But, you know, it all looked like fluff. It all looked like just fun stuff, you know.
I see. So it was, very sort of double life, sort of pretending to write like a review of a holiday or whatever, you know. Blogging, exactly. If you like.
It was a blog. Yeah, it was. Yeah. It was a blog. But it showed his contacts. And for example, the famous lawyer Daniel Webster was one of the people who engineered what's called the Fugitive Slave Act, which was a law that permitted Southerners to come and chase their slaves up in the North, and it also made it illegal to hide slaves. You know, you had could catch them, you had to give them back, and there was a bounty on them, you know. So it was a terrible law, and Daniel Webster did it by way of trying to compromise with the South. You know, he was trying to avoid a war, and he was trying to compromise, so he really sold out with this thing. So a month after this thing becomes law, Matthew, in his travelogue character, meets with Daniel Webster. You know, a totally unlikely person for him to meet with. He meets with him, but all it talks about is they both had colds. He was there when Daniel Webster was eating his breakfast. Daniel Webster takes him around the farm and shows him his fruit trees. And there's one sentence that says, oh, and they also talked about national affairs. So, you know, so it's all very light. See, it's all kept very light. But he's reported now in his column that he did in fact successfully meet with Daniel Webster. So that's like, he also met with Victor Hugo, the author, in Paris, same kind of deal, you know, just a social visit, you know. So goes on like that. Yeah.
So at the end of Matthew's life, did he ever come out clean and say, yes, I was an agent? Because obviously it wasn't a problem maybe later on in life to kind of say that, or was it always kept quiet right until his dying day?
Everything was kept quiet. He didn't even tell his brother all of the work that he had written, you know. So he didn't tell his brother, he didn't tell anybody, he kept it all. He told one person, and he appears to have told one person, a friend and an editor and a collaborator, that he had written The Raven, and the guy didn't believe him, made fun of him. So Matthew went along with the joke, you know, he didn't believe him. So the problem is nobody would believe him. I've been asked this question many times, you know, well, why didn't he just tell somebody, you know, after the Civil War when it wasn't really an issue? The problem is that nobody would believe him, even if he did.
Hmm. Stephen, I've got an interesting question. In your research, a lot of people, when they have kind of like reincarnation, either flashbacks or they go under past life regression, it can be traumatic, but they're usually the victim, or it's a fairly interesting, you know, uplifting life. Maybe they were kind of, I don't know, Cleopatra or something like that. Have you ever come across anybody who is nice in nature, but when they've gone back, they were something like a Nazi or something like a Satanist, or you know, somebody who sacrificed people on the pyramids of, you know, the Incan steppes, or even a serial killer, you know, anyone that's kind of like was H.H. Holmes in a previous life?
Well, there was one guy that was all of those things. No, just kidding.
Shit, he must have been a bad
Nice guy. No. Well, yeah, there's lots of there's lots of records in the, you know, in the accounts of past life therapy that comes up quite a bit. If you read Roger Wilger's book, I think it's called Other Lives, Other Selves. I mean, being a therapist, he's bringing people back into very traumatic lifetimes where they, you know, did horrible things, but at least where they experienced horrible things. But at least a couple of the cases, he takes them further back and finds that they were actually a perpetrator further back. Mm. So, Dr. Ian Stevenson studying children who remembered their just previous lifetime didn't run into things like that. But people like Dr. Wilger, who went quite a bit further back, he did find those sorts of things.
What do you think of the theory that when somebody has perpetrated evil, that somehow the universe kind of dumps their soul back into a body to experience what they've done to other people?
Well, I think that happens. And I think the soul itself wants it. For example, with Dr. Wilger, I attended one of his seminars, and when he needed a volunteer, I immediately raised my hand quick before anybody else. So I got to have a session with him. And one of the things I seemed to remember, and I say seemed to because I don't have any evidence for this life, you know, but what I remembered was that I had been in some position of authority, a prince or, you know, something like that, and that I had misused my authority and put people in the dungeon and, you know, stuff like that, nice things like that. And then toward the end of my life, I renounced it all, you know, and I said, no, I don't want that. You know, I don't want to be like that. And I went to a monastery and I lived the last couple years or whatever in a monastery. And I remember dying. I was in a cell with two other monks and I was lying down on a wooden bench, and dying was just a little moment of confusion, you know, no big deal. So I'm out. And then I meet the Christ is what I remember. And he says, you're forgiven. But the important thing here is that I said, whether I'm forgiven or not, I want to go back and make it right. You know, I have to make this right. So it's this deep need of the soul to make things right that causes this business, you know, of coming back. I mean, you may be forgiven, but you don't want to leave it like that.
Right? Mm. Yeah. I mean, when you say you died in this cell with other monks and you said it was really nothing to it, a bit of a confusion, did you actually experience a death? I mean, what was your recollection of that?
That's it. I mean, that's all I remember. I'm not going to embellish it, you know, try not to embellish anything. That's literally what I remembered. Now, Dr. Wilger doesn't use hypnosis. He uses emotion, what they call the affect bridge or emotion. He uses association, like gestalt techniques, but it works just as well. But that's what I remember. I mean, I can still feel it. You know, I can kind of go back to that, but I can't expand on it at all. This is the way, for me, past life memory operates. I get a glimpse, but I can never expand it or make it into anything else. I call it like five frames of a film, and that's all I got, you know? So that's why I can remember what it felt like. There was just, I'm lying on this wooden bench and there's just like a moment of confusion and I'm out, you know? It was, yeah.
Interesting.
Now, I remember Matthew's death too, actually, I think. Again, I can't prove this, but what I remember with him, he apparently had terrible sharp stomach pains, terrible, you know, pains like a ulcer, like he was dying of an ulcer. And what I remember is when I got out of my body, there was this huge relief, like what I had read was true. You know, oh my gosh, yeah, it's true. It was real, you know, because I wasn't sure. I always had this skeptical side of myself. I'd read all this stuff, you know, but that was my first impression was, oh, it was real, you know.
And it's a relief to be out of your body, especially if it's giving you a jipe like that.
I don't remember that.
It's interesting.
Yeah.
Though.
All I remember is that impression, that thought that came to me was the relief of the things that I had read about and studied and felt somewhat skeptical about that, whew, you know.
Because a lot of people that when they do come back through mediums, whether it's automatic writing or directly or voice trance or something like that, a lot of them do say that they're actually, when they're asked about their death, they say, oh, it was good to get rid of that old body. It was finally, you know, to get rid of that because it's such a weight upon them that once they're free of it, they felt released and out of pain and things like that. And that's obviously mostly people that are a lot older and suffering from ill health from age or something.
Well, you'd think I would, but again, I don't want to report something I didn't experience. You know, I don't remember that. What I do think is that Matthew was he's known to have been very gullible and very naive. And as I look at his life, just about everybody surrounding him toward the end was hypocritical, you know, So he's, I think as soon as you get out, you can see people's thoughts and you can see what people's real motivations are. And I think that he went through a period of trying to get revenge. I think he may have been earthbound for a while trying to get revenge. He couldn't let go of it. You know, he had a strong streak of revenge, vengeance in him.
And do you feel that there's elements of his character within you now that you can think, I can re-identify with that?
A lot.
Revenge or gullibility or whatever it may be?
A lot. Yeah, it's just that I progress. You can progress it like age progression. You know, you can take those traits and I can progress them through some of what I've learned. Like, for example, with the sarcasm, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. I still have that. It was very strong when I was in grade school. I went through a period where I was the head of a group called the Odors. And we went around putting everything down, you know, making fun of everything, making sarcastic comments. And finally, I was called to the office. And I was made to sit down at a big round table. I had a piece of paper and a pencil, and I was told to write down, I think it was 15 nice things. That was my punishment, right? And I couldn't do it. I had a heck of a time thinking of 15 nice things to write down. You know, I'm 12 years old or whatever. No, 11 years old. Yeah, I couldn't think of them. You know, I mean, I was that much, but that was Matthew. See, I mean, that was Matthew coming through at that point. So I kind of tempered that a little bit, you know. I backed off on that, but I still have it in myself.
And, you know, you talk about the Edgar Allan Poe character who I believe when he died, he actually mysteriously vanished, didn't he? He didn't actually.
Well, no, he mysteriously died. Nobody knows for sure what he died of.
Right. So he didn't vanish. He just mysteriously died of some illness. But there was actually a grave of him somewhere.
Is that sorry.
There's actually a grave. He has a tombstone or a grave or something.
I believe so. I seem to read it. There's somebody that leaves a half-emptied bottle of wine at his grave every year or something like that. So I think there is a grave. Yeah.
That's unearned.
Mysterious person. Well, the funny thing is that he didn't write The Raven, and that's mainly what they, you know, celebrate him for. He didn't write it. So there's talk about shocks. There's going to be a huge shock when I'm ever really taken seriously, because I have the evidence, but I can't get anybody to take me seriously, you know, so far. It's just such a hard sell, you know, because everybody knows that Poe wrote The Raven. Why do they know? Because they were taught that.
Of course.
The only reason you know, so I mean, it's just like, you know, the sun is in the sky and Edgar Allan Poe wrote The Raven and everybody knows both those things. It's that deeply embedded, you know. But if I go back to the time, I can see that it was a big scam.
I was going to say, Stephen, have you got any recollections of the time in between lives? That's another interesting aspect.
The only thing I've got is that I think that I was earthbound for a little while, you know, in that lifetime. And I think I did it specifically to get revenge. And I think it really held me up quite badly.
So you would be kind of what's known as a ghost.
Well, I'm just guessing because I don't know for sure. But that's what it looks like. Yeah.
And do you know what kind of made you move on or what the process was for thinking, oh, screw this, I'm just going to go?
No, I don't. I don't have any idea. I mean, I could make guesses, but I'm just going on impressions. I'm trying to, as I did under hypnosis, I'm trying to stick with the original impressions and not embellish them, because that's where you get into trouble. I mean,
You was a sarcastic ghost, I guess. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's what first clued me into it. And then once I started thinking about it, I started feeling it. So, yeah, I think that's what happened. Matthew's daughter, Lizzie or Elizabeth, married Matthew's nemesis, basically a guy that gave him trouble all his life, an older fellow. And they had a son named Greenleaf. Well, Greenleaf was a real pistol, as they say. He was a real handful. And he was kind of mean to Matthew's brother, you know, John Greenleaf Whittier, his uncle. Or I have a great uncle, I think. But anyway, he was mean to him. He did things like grab his hat and pull it down over his ears and stuff like that. Well, I think Matthew was inspiring him to do those things. To get back at him, because he could see that his brother had been hypocritical toward him, and he used the boy to get back at him. That had karmic repercussions. I mean, you can't do stuff like that without it really holding you back. So
this was you as a ghost.
That's what I think. Yeah, that's what. Because I mean, you know, the accounts of this little boy being mean to John Greenleaf Whittier are historical. And John Greenleaf Whittier finally, in exasperation, said something to the effect that it would have been better if he hadn't been born or something like that, you know, you know, but But and eventually he grew up and became a scientist and contributed to the radio, you know, the development of the radio and things like that. But when I read that, it just hit me, you know, intuitively. I said, wait a minute, I think Matthew was influencing him to do that stuff, you know, and that's all I have is just that impression. These are things you can't prove, you know.
And when that life of Matthew passed away, are you aware of any other lives you've taken before you became who you are now?
I think so. And again, I can't prove it, but there's one, the one that the psychic mentioned, the woman who was a writer on the West Coast. I think I've got some kind of a scenario worked out for her, but I can't find her in a historical record. I think she was a reporter and a photographer. And I think she started out in the Shenandoah Valley, ended up in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and then somehow made it over to the West Coast. I think that she had some connection with Ansel Adams and Edward Weston, the photographers. And I think I know how she died. I think she had a little car and she had stopped it and was listening to the radio. She'd like leaned back in her seat and closed her eyes and was listening to the radio. And I found out they did have, in fact, have radios in 1930 in the cars, but she must have not put it in gear, or she must not have put on the handbrake, because she rolled backwards over some kind of embankment and was killed. So, I mean, you'd think I'd be able to find that, but I have the feeling maybe I'm not supposed to find it. Then I think there's a more recent one. And the reason I say that is I used to work in the receiving department of a business that bought and sold used cameras. And every day the trucks would back up, you know, and there's a white one, the FedEx truck, and then there's a brown one, the UPS truck. Well, when the truck would back up, I would pick up the big rolling door, and then they would roll their door up and the guy would bring the boxes out. So I never felt anything with the FedEx, but when the brown UPS truck rolled the back up of his truck up, I felt panic, absolute panic. That was like didn't make any sense. And then it came to me, I think that I was a little boy during the Holocaust, and that I was taken with a group of people for a walk in the woods by the Nazis. And I was so little and naive that I thought we were just going for a wonderful walk in the woods. And then we got to a clearing, there's these trucks there, the backs roll up, there's machine guns, and they mow us all down. So that maybe I was 5 or 6, you know. But again, I have no proof of that either. It just kind of came to me, and, you know, based on the feeling, I tried to follow the feeling I had when that UPS truck rolled up, you know, where's this coming from? And that's what I got when I tried to follow the feeling.
And when you say you follow that feeling, how do you, I mean, obviously you can't do that at the work situation. So you go home, you think about the UPS truck and think, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to meditate on that scenario as it happened. And then you recreate the feeling, I presume. And then what, you suddenly get a vision of Nazis or something?
No, it's on a feeling level in my case, not for everybody. I'm not psychic, you know, really. So, but it's more like letting it come through than making it come through. You know, in other words, you've been blocking it, so you just stop blocking it. So the classic example in the kind of therapy that Dr. Wilger did was somebody is saying that they have a stabbing pain in their stomach. And so the therapist says, what kind of pain is that? He says, a stabbing pain. Say that again, a stabbing pain. Say it again, a stabbing pain, a stabbing pain. And suddenly they flip. Suddenly they flip into remembering being stabbed in the stomach. See? In other words, that association and that emotion removes whatever the block was, the amnesia block, and it comes through.
My gosh. And like when people have died of certain injuries, they seem to have scars sometimes, don't they? Depending on, you know, how they might have died, whether it was a mark on the neck being, you know, cut in the neck by a weapon of some kind. I mean, did you sort of, have you kind of found any inexplicable scars on your body or marks or anything like that that might?
No, but I've had a lot of trouble with my digestion, and Matthew had what they called dyspepsia for most of his life. So that has carried through. And some other physical problems that he have carried through, but no marks. I mean, he didn't have any marks that I know of, you know, but Dr. Ian Stevenson studied that and documented it very well, because he had a little boy that remembered his past life like his other subjects, but he had these scars. So they find the person he was in his previous life. They find how he died. He was shot. And then they find the autopsy report, and the autopsy report has the bullet wound entrance and exit in the same place that the kid has the, you know, birthmark. Wow. So, yeah.
Wow. That's pretty spooky, that one.
Yeah, pretty strong stuff. And then not just one case, but quite a few of them.
Mm.
Stephen, can you jump to another lifetime and give us an insight into another one you had?
Well, again, none of these are proven. You know, and I'm all about proof, so I don't really know. Let's see. I think that I was a druid, a Celtic priest around AD 400, because that came up in a psychic reading with the same woman that told me about the writer on the West Coast. And then with Dr. Wolger, I seemed to be able to remember some more of that. And what I remembered was I'm kneeling at an altar, and the scene is it's a mound. This is before I really had seen any of these things, you know, pictures of any of these things. So I'm on a mound, I don't know, maybe 20 feet high or 25 feet high or something. And I don't know how wide it is, but I'm up there and there's altars at three equidistant points around the periphery. Okay. And they look like the symbol pi, kind of. There's two uprights and a cross piece. It's polished granite. And I'm doing some kind of ritual, kneeling in front of this thing, putting little objects on it, or, you know, I don't know what I'm doing. And then a group of men come and attack me, and I try to run for it. So I'm trying to run down this mound, and there is, let's see, there's three entrances, one next to the other, that go into the ground, that go underground, okay? And they have uprights. Each one has a upright stone and a stone across the top, and they're 1, 2, 3, and I'm trying to make it into these one of these things, and they catch me and they cut my throat, I think. The psychic said, "You weren't very brave," she said. and I just, now here's an interesting thing. Just recently I found a new piece by Matthew, and he's writing about a story about the French Revolution, and he's writing about people condemned to the guillotine or guillotine. So, I mean, this thing was still on his mind, you know, this whole overwhelming issue of having your head cut off or your neck cut or anything, you know, like that. It was bothering him still, you know. So that's now Matthew appears to have remembered a life as a high Jewish priest, as a rabbi, because he gives a couple of hints about this, two or three hints. And years ago, I had a psychic reading, and the first thing she said was, "Has anybody told you you are a rabbi?" And I said, "Well, no." She says, "You've got rabbi all over you." You know, so it appears that Matthew was getting readings just as I've gotten readings, because he was a spiritualist. So we know for sure he got readings. So he was getting some of the same information about, you know, past life, you know, that I've been getting.
Wow. Now, this is just a little anecdote. It's not really majorly important, but I suppose you could call it a notation if this was a book. About maybe 2 years ago, perhaps. Yeah, I think about 2 years ago, my girlfriend and I were having a spontaneous a Ouija board session that we were invited to. We didn't know the people, but we were there as bums on seats, basically, to fill up to make a unit of four people. And we were called, only a few hours notice, would we like to do it? The people we'd heard of had got a good reputation for accuracy and stuff. So we said, yes, okay. And so we were invited to take part in this spontaneous reading. And my girlfriend's late husband came through, and he was a fan of the band Pink Floyd. So we was asking test questions, and we said, one of the things we said, "Oh, what did you like to listen to, you know, on CD or music?" And he said, he started to spell the letters out, and it went P, and we thought, oh yeah, he's gonna write Pink Floyd. But then it went O, and then it went E, and it spelled out the letters Poe. And I thought, what's going on here? You know, Poe, what does that mean? And then my girlfriend suddenly said, oh yes, I forgot that he used to like listening to the stories on CD of Edgar Allan Poe.
Awesome, yeah.
So you're thinking, oh, crikey. So it wasn't the expectation of Pink Floyd that we were expecting him to say, because we always used to speak about Pink Floyd and the connection with him. And here he was coming through something unexpectedly, talking about Edgar Allan Poe, and he had listened to the CDs or writings or something of it, you know. But I mean, it's just a little aside, as I say, a small notation.
That's awesome.
Edgar Allan Poe. So you talked about your previous lives and different connections there, and they seem to be aware themselves of having previous lives, which is quite an indication of some sort of psychic ability that you seem to have carried. I mean, you say you haven't got psychic ability, but to be aware of a previous life, I would imagine you've got to have some sort of ability of some sort to tune into previous lives.
I think everybody has this feeling on emotion. I think emotions from past lives and recognition. See, I found that emotions are coming right on through, and recognition is pretty easy to get, you know, but the problem is discounting it. Problem is believing it, not having it, you know. So you've got to get your cynicism and skepticism out of the way and let it come through and recognize it when it does come through. So if you can do that, that's a matter of faith, I guess, or open-mindedness, or rigorously sticking to the truth regardless of whether it, you know, comes out the way you like it or not. If you can learn to do that and get your skepticism out of the way, then I think everybody has these things. But Matthew was also getting readings, so some of this stuff probably came through psychic readings.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I've had psychic readings, and you know, I can't remember what they've said now. That some of them so long ago, and I was perhaps very young then, so maybe I wasn't as methodical as I am now when I record these things, and I would just try and remember them. And you know, they might have said, "Oh, I remember being told by a spirit guide once in a reading." That I had been something to do with Egypt. Like I might have been an Egyptian priest of some sort, and I worked with crystals. And you're thinking, oh, wow, that sounds cool. But at the end of it, like you say, I can't really prove that or anything. You know, where do you start? The fact, oh, I'm an Egyptian priest. Well, that's cool. So how does that affect me in this life? You know, there's nothing I can really do about it. And I feel kind of, at least with your more recent histories, you've got something to check back on, I guess, which is encouraging, I guess.
Yeah, I was able to prove this one. But the other ones, the only evidence I have is that Matthew appears to have been getting the same information that I've got in a few cases. So that's some kind of cross correspondence. It's not really very strong, but it's interesting, you know.
Mm. Now, we have on the Paranormal Peep Show interviewed people that have done regression therapy using hypnosis, and sometimes they've reported when they've done hypnosis on people where they've brought through alien beings, whether they're like in contact with them or previous lives or lives that are coexisting. It was an interesting snippet because you always expect to, you know, when you're being regressed, to have a past life, not an alien being come through. I mean, what do you think of that?
Well, the first time that I was successfully hypnotized was actually a past life therapy session. And in that session, I seem to recall a couple lifetimes being either in ancient advanced civilization here on Earth or on another planet. But, you know, I mean, I have to be open-minded about it. I have no evidence. It made sense in terms of, you know, my emotional makeup and what I was going through. But again, I can't prove it. But that happened to me too. Something like that came through, you know. So and it makes sense, you know, in context. But that's about all I can say for it.
Yeah. Because, I mean, there's lots of – obviously, we have bigger discussions going on to do with aliens and space and ET and everything.
Sure.
And a lot of people that we speak to talk about that we're connected to them and or we've been genetically modified or et cetera, et cetera. So I suppose if you want to sort of follow that reincarnational route, you go back and you sort of – you think, well, maybe there is a connection to these ETs and aliens, and maybe we have come from other planets, and so therefore we will remember them. But, you know, I suppose the more recent lifetimes are the ones that are bubbling just under our conscious selves at the moment.
Not sure. You know, the ancient ones come up just as strong as the recent ones.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like yesterday, you know.
Wow.
All feels like yesterday. Yeah. Well, here, I'll tell you one of the ones that I remembered. So I'm an overseer. Okay. And I don't know if you call me a slave master, but I'm an overseer, and there's people that are under my jurisdiction or control. I'm standing at some kind of a, I don't know if it's a platform or a podium or an observation station. Anyway, I'm standing in this elevated place, and there's kind of like a subway operating like a pneumatic tube coming with these people. And, but it's kind of organic. It's like a trail of bubbles almost, you know, it's like, it's transparent and it's kind of organic. Like it would be bigger if there was more people and shorter if there was fewer people, that kind of thing. So they're coming, and I just have the sense that I'm overseeing this, and I'm kind of, dispassionate. I'm kind of, you know, kind of by the book. Well, this also goes with a psychic reading I had about Rome, that I was somebody, you know, kind of a small official in Rome, and went it by the book. And she said, I caused a few settlements to be destroyed or something awful. Talk about being a horrible person. That's what I was told. You know, well, it kind of fits with this lifetime, because I feel like I was without emotion, you know, and I was just supervising these people. No thought about, you know, is it right for me to be, you know, enslaving them or nothing like that, you know. But I didn't feel like I was, you know, looked like an alien the way that, you know, we see the grays and so on. I felt like I looked maybe a tall human being or whatever. But if you fast forward to Matthew's lifetime, Matthew's whole life was dedicated to doing away with slavery, you know, and to helping out people who were unfortunate, you know, in society.
Right. So it was like,
I think he was undoing. I think he was undoing that. Yeah. I think it goes all the way back to that. Yeah.
That's interesting. So there seems to be a theme. And also, you know, you mentioned about the lady that you possibly might have been that rolled back in the car, having connection with photographers, and you've worked yourself with a camera company, and media and things like that. And that seems to be a bit of a theme with writing, media, photography as well, the video.
Well, and Matthew was fascinated with photography also. He was personal friends with a guy named Ernest Lacan, I think his name was, who wrote, published a photography magazine in Paris, like in 1851, something like that, like one of the very first ones. You know, Matthew was friends with him, and he loved to go to daguerreotype shops and look at the, you know, pictures and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose that was just when it was all coming out, this kind of photography sort of stuff. So it would have been quite an amazing thing for people. Yeah. And certainly if you moved in those circles, you'd perhaps try and do everything to be involved in it.
Well, he also was an art critic. I mean, so he knew good art from bad, and, you know, he was had a highly developed aesthetic sense. So it wasn't just he also was fascinated by technology, but it was also the art of it.
Have you had any kind of inclinations, and this is going to sound a crazy question, but of any possible future lives? Now, okay, there's the argument that it hasn't happened yet, but there's also the argument that I know you said you don't believe that all lives are happening at the same time, but what if there is no such thing as time in the bigger picture? Could you dip into maybe a future life that has happened, but not in your consciousness awareness?
Well, I mean, it's hard to ask a crazy question with somebody like me, but I am still in touch. I got back in touch with Matthew's soulmate, who's now my soulmate. So we have a relationship, and I can communicate with her in a manner of speaking. And the impression I got from her is that she can see the future to a limited extent. It's kind of like, the impression I get from her is energy vortexes, you know, energy nexus, she calls them, you know, that if something is really powerful, she can see it in the future. You know, that we don't know how for sure we're going to get there, but it's already there, is what I understand from her. You know, so it is possible to see to some limited extent into the future. And that's, I think, what psychic ability, a lot of it is based on, is people connect with somebody on the other side who reports to them, you know, what they can see of it. So it's not omniscience, you know, it's not, but still you can see trends, or you can see, and it's not more than trends. It's like energy pathways, you know. But now there have been people who have been progressed and have reported future lifetimes. I've never seen anything that's been verified that I know of, where somebody said that such and such was going to happen, and then 20 years later, turns out they were correct. I haven't seen that.
So you say that you're now in contact with your former lover from the previous life, who died 5 years before Matthew did. Matthew dying after their marriage. Their marriage. Yeah.
Correct.
And so when you say you were in contact, how has that been initiated?
Well, it's kind of a long story. We got time though, I guess. Trading out with the hypnotherapist. I couldn't afford her services, but I traded out. So I created background music for a CD that she was doing for the Monroe Institute, a self-help CD. I was creating it on GarageBand, in the Mac. And she wanted samples. So I was creating these samples, and she didn't really like any of them except one. One of them was totally out of place. It was totally different than all the others, and it sounded like a lilting little French song, very sad song, And she said, I want that one, Can you simplify it and slow it down, everything? And I suddenly got very huffy, very upset. And I told her, you can't have that one. That's a message from my soulmate on the other side. And that I just blurted this out, because I got very defensive. You can't have that one, And I'm like, where did that come from? But I had the feeling, gee, maybe, Abby is trying to contact me. So I tried to be open to it. And it seemed like I could feel her presence sometimes and then other times not. So I was thinking, oh, maybe she's gotten tired of me and, left or whatever, So that's when I got the first psychic medium to try to contact her. Matter of fact, both of them, their instruction was to try to contact her. And came through with bells on. Matter of fact, the medium told me she almost called me an hour before the session because she was getting blasted with images. That's how eager Abby was to talk to me, But before that, when I first wrote to her, she said, I asked her for a reading. This is the same one that told me about the rabbi, all over me many years earlier. So I knew her and I had readings from her. She says, well, looking at you psychically is like looking at a mirror in a funhouse, all distorted. And she says, and you've got an attached spirit, and I won't read you. She refused to read me. So I explained, I didn't want to tell her anything. So then I explained to her, well, I've been studying my past life, and I feel like my wife from that lifetime once is trying to communicate with me. And then she said, okay, now I can see that. So, she picked up on it before I told her anything. And apparently what she saw was that I'm melding my past life self with my present life self in such a way that I kind of don't know who I am. Sometimes I feel like Matthew, sometimes I feel like myself. It's I'm kind of got a foot in both lifetimes.
Kind of and confusing.
from the psychic point of view, apparently it looks kind of weird,
Yeah, because that's the thing. When you die and you want to go and say, oh, well, I'll go and be with my late husband or late wife or go and meet my parents, at some point, if you go along with the reincarnation idea, is that your grandparents in the spirit world will leave you to presumably go and reincarnate.
Yeah.
And so it sounds like you've now come back, but the wife has stayed there, perhaps.
She stayed there, yeah. Well, there was a reason for that. I needed this remedial training. I mean, I really, what they call fell, I mean, I really went backwards, partly because of the vengeance issue, and whatever I did to try to get revenge. And because the other thing is my third wife in that lifetime, which was a practical lifetime. It was just a practical marriage. I mean, and she really never really loved him and betrayed him, apparently, and long story short, after he died, she found some other guy who was a con artist and took her for everything she had and really messed with her mind. I think Matthew arranged that in revenge. That's my feeling. Because they can do that. On the other side, they can bring people together. They can influence in such a way to bring people into your orbit. And Abby has brought evidence for my research into my orbit. So I know they can do it. But I did it in a negative way, and I think that has repercussions. So all that stuff held me back. And I think I had a lot to work out before I would have been ready to be with Abby again. So I think she had to kind of wait this one out and sit back and let me go through a whole bunch of crap, till I got back to where I was. Yeah. And then when I was ready, then she could contact me. That's my impression of it.
I suppose the reason why some spirits don't come through, and I've had this myself and experienced this with the fairs that I do, some people say, I really want to speak to my grandmother or my mother or my father, and somebody else will come through that's not them, and they kind of they get disheartened.
Right.
Could it be that that soul has actually, for whatever reason, jumped back into another body and isn't really available?
I think it happens, but love is so powerful, a bond, that one way or another, you're going to be with them, either on the other side or here, or in my case, even just across the veil, you know, somehow or other, love will draw you together. So I don't think anybody ever has to fear that they're cut off from somebody. It's just, it depends on where the meeting is going to be. That's all.
Because I was thinking about this today or yesterday, that, you know, my grandfather died back in 1978, I think it was. And I'm thinking, God, you know, I only knew him for about 11 or 12 years, and then he died. And I've been alive longer than I knew
him. Right.
And when I eventually die, maybe, I don't know, in the next 30, 40 years or whatever it might be, I don't know, maybe less, will he still be there, or has he gone on to the next lifetime? You know, it's just a bizarre thing.
Yeah, one way or another, yeah. But here's the thing. Carol Bowman wrote a book called Return from Heaven, in which she documents the phenomenon of children, people being born back again into their families. So you've got little kids who are their own grandfather and things like that, you know. So that happens apparently a lot more often than we would think. So that's another way it can happen.
Yeah, because I read in some, I don't know if you're familiar with the Seth material, Jane Roberts. She used to channel this entity, Seth. And so one of the topics he discussed through her was obviously reincarnation. He did sort of talk about simultaneous time, but he, for practical purposes, he would talk about the past as if it was the past. But he would say that, you know, whole villages would reincarnate and come back again. All the people that knew each other in a village, say, of the 1500s, will come back as a town in Midwest America or where it might be, maybe 300 years later. And everyone that's in that village would have known each other, you know, a few hundred years previously, because they're having their working out issues between themselves, you know, finishing up things that weren't quite done. And it's really, it's not just to live a life of practicality. It's actually to, on a deeper level, learn about oneself, I suppose. I don't know. I mean,
well, it's all about connection. So yeah. the connections stay, you know, and you tend to get drawn back together. You know, I moved to Portland, Maine, where Matthew lived for 21 years. And I swear, I can't prove it, but I swear I'm bumping into people that he knew. I'm certainly ending up in the places where, you know, running into the places that he was associated with, you know, and not really by my own choosing. It's just sort of working out like that, you know, and I think I'm bumping into some of the same people too, which is, you know, unfortunately I can't prove any of that, but it's fascinating because I'm pretty sure I'm right about it.
So you didn't consciously move to Portland, Maine because
of this?
Oh, no, I did
that. Oh, yeah.
I did do that, right.
But I'm ending, for example, I live in an attic, and Matthew also lived in attics, you know. Well, I didn't purposely try to get an attic. It just, it was cheaper, but one came available, you know, and I took it, you know. Well, I don't see them that often. You know, they don't come open that often, but this one came open and I took it. Well, it turns out that if I look out my front window to the houses across the street, the railroad used to run right through the middle of those houses, and Matthew would have gone right by here. You know, he would have looked out the window and seen this place, you know. And, you know, there's a hill, two, three, four blocks from where I live that I walk on. And when I saw that hill, I had a flashback that Abby and I were riding out to the country from the city. And when we saw this huge hill, we would start, you know, she would get nervous. She was kind of nervous. She'd get nervous about climbing this big thing. But we would, as we approached the hill, we would get out to make it easier for the horse to bring the carriage up the hill, you know. And it was like, you know, it was like high good humor, you know. She was nervous, but we would laugh and joke about it. And it was like a high point, you know, to get over that hill so that we could get out to the country and have our picnic or whatever. Well, that came to me, you know. I can't prove that one because it's not written down anywhere. You know, if it's in a diary someplace or a letter somewhere, I could prove it. But it came to me very clearly, and I feel it every single time I walk there and look at that hill. I can feel the same impression, you know, no more, no less. Never gets any more, just the five frames of film, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, again, getting back to Seth, I remember him saying in one of the books that he channeled through Jane Roberts that in one particular lifetime he was a Franciscan monk or something, and he was having to copy a handwritten manuscript from a few hundred centuries earlier. But it actually, from his higher self perspective, maybe, or his Seth perspective, realized that he was the actual said author of the same manuscript.
He was recording his own stuff. Well, I'm doing that too. Yeah. I'm copying my own stuff now. Yeah, same thing. And I think that happens more often than we realize.
So as an artist, I mean, I do artwork and things like that. And now I don't go around repairing old-fashioned artworks and things like that. But I'd imagine if I did such a job where I'd have to repair an archival artworks, there would be a weird twist of fate that I would be repairing artworks that I painted 200 or 300 years.
Well, here's the question. Do you feel that you had past lives doing art?
I'm not sure. I've always been really good at art. Andy's the same. He's an artist. He's more graphic design based. Mm. But you know, it's quite possible that the skills that Andy and I have brought into this life as artists, drawing and colouring and stuff like that, the fact that we're naturally good at it suggests to me that, well, it's one of those kind of skill sets you're born with. And it doesn't seem that hard to improve upon, whereas other people that can't even draw a matchstick man have a real hard time drawing, whereas Andy and I could both draw reasonably well facsimiles of dogs, cats, animals, people, whatever, freehand. And that could come from another life, maybe. It's hard to say. What do you think, Andy?
I mean, I would say the same. I'd say from my past experience, hand in hand seems to be creativity, intuition, working with spirit, spirituality, and art and music. And I think it's the right brain, isn't it, that deals with that kind of thing? Because I think the left brain is the analytical, kind of skeptical, rational side, and then the intuitive, artistic side is the right side.
Yeah, I personally think you can't have a talent like that without it having been developed in a previous life. It's impossible. And not only that, you can't have the interest in it.
Yeah,
it's impossible to get interested in a thing. You know, take somebody that just draws, you know, match figures. You know, you can't get it. They could probably learn, but they're not interested. You know, you can't get them interested.
So, you know, in another lifetime, I will probably be an artistic bloody, I don't know, top of the game artist or something, you know. I mean, it was like one of the things that I remember reading about Leonardo da Vinci, you know, is that somehow that he was so spot on with his artwork that he was also a really head of the game, that he was like designing submarines and flight and things like that, as if he was in tune with something 700 or 800 years into his future. You know, and again, is that something to do with parallel lives or simultaneous time? Interesting, the fact that he was ahead of his game like that, you know.
Well, it could have been from a more, there's been advanced civilizations on this planet before in a cyclical, you know, in a cycle. So he could have reincarnated from a previous technological high point, or it could be another, or another planet, either one.
So you've got a bit of an uphill battle trying to prove your previous existences, the connection to Edgar Allan Poe. Where do you think you're at with that now, Stephen?
Well, I've tried everything I can think of. I have a book. I have a book I just wrote called Reincarnation Can Be Proven, with the emphasis on can. I just sold one copy yesterday, so that's two. So Dr. Jim Tucker, the successor of Dr. Ian Stevenson, wrote me that he was going to buy one for their department. So, and then I sent him a signed one also, but he was nice enough to buy one because he says he knows what it's like being an author. So he bought one, and then some unknown person bought a second one. So now I have twice as many sales as I had before, you know.
He's doubled his output. Yeah.
I doubled. Yeah. So another thing I did was with regard to these famous attributions, and I want to say that there's other people that claimed Matthew's work that were not famous. There's about 14 of them total. So I just mentioned the famous ones for shock value, but there's a lot of them that only two or three historians have, you know, heard of. But I wrote to English professors in America, the UK, and Canada. And I went through every website of every college and looked through all the English professors, and I wrote individual letters to the ones that had some interest in those areas. And I got a handful of responses, nobody who took me seriously, and the rest of them didn't. But that was something I tried, just to try to scare up a little interest. I created some videos, three videos that explain my evidence that Matthew was the real author of The Raven. And I put links on everything that has to do with Poe and The Raven that I can find online and on YouTube. And nobody pays much attention to that. So I can't crack the nut yet, you know, but I'm still working on it. Yeah. I mean, Abby tells me it's like lighting a fire, that nothing happens, like, you know, trying to light a fire with flint, you know, with sparks, that nothing happens until it catches, you know? So the phase I'm in is the phase where I'm striking away and nothing's happening, but
well,
not
we'll
to get
keep
discouraged.
Fanning the flames as much as we can from this.
There
end.
We go. Yeah.
And this recording's hopefully something towards that.
I've got the evidence. That's the thing. It's just a matter of breaking through the societal denial. I have the evidence.
And you have a website to publish?
Yeah.
This
it's www.ial. For In Another Life, IAL.goldthread.com, GOLDTHREAD.com.
Okay. Well, thank you very, very much, Stephen, for taking part in our Paranormal Peep Show. And we wish you well with your future endeavors and maybe your future lifetimes as well. Whoever you come back as in your next life, it'd be interesting. Maybe you better write yourself a letter, you know.
Matthew wrote me one, so I'll try to write him one as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Andy, any last thoughts before we say cheerio?
Yes, well, hopefully this show will reincarnate into another version, and perhaps Stephen can come on for a future one. I do want to once again say, anyone in the southeast of England who's looking for something a bit spooky, there's a few demonstrations coming up as well, a few audience demos that we're doing at Tuned In events. And a demonstration for people who don't know is where you've got a medium or mediums at the front of an audience giving messages to an audience. So there's quite a few of those coming up. Interspersed with one-to-ones nights. So if you go onto www.tunedinevents.co.uk or find us on Facebook and join the group and see what we're doing. We've got about 30 events coming up between now and Halloween and sort of November time.
Okay, well, this show goes out in November, so some of those events would have passed, but
okay,
remember that, bear that in mind. But certainly for you got Christmas stuff in the pipeline.
Yeah, there'll be some Christmas stuff coming along soon, definitely.
Excellent.
To be booked at the moment.
To be booked. Okay, so stay tuned to Tuned In Events for Andy's upcoming events. And tune in to Stephen for news of his past lives. And tune in to us next time on the Paranormal Peep Show on the Paranormal UK Radio Network. Good night.
See you later.